This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Certainly tough in the overall market, trades and broad-based selling, but not selling. Investors snapping up, in fact, shares of Tapestry. Stock has been as high as 19% in today's session, still holding on to about a 14% gain. And this despite the parent of Coach and Kate Spade cutting its profit outlook due to pandemic closures in China. Meantime, a bright spot, North American demand lifting third quarter sales above estimate. So let's get to the quarter and find out what the consumer is up to. Delighted to be talking once again with Joanne Crevoiserat. She is CEO of Tapestry in she is on the phone in New York City. Joanne, so nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you and how is the retail environment doing?
Yeah, well, thank you, Carol and Tim. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. What we're seeing in our business is strength and momentum across our business. As you mentioned, our third quarter outperformed, led by strength in North America, and we drove double-digit global sales growth across all of our brands at Coach, at Kate Spade, and at Stuart Weitzman. And, you know, Tapestry is a powerful combination of iconic brands that offer tremendous value for consumers, and we have a platform that we've transformed to drive innovation and customer engagement. And that model is delivering results. We're seeing that in the strength of our digital business, increased customer acquisition, and pricing power across brands. So a lot of things are working and performing, and it really reflects the strategies that we've put in place over the last few years to stay closer to our consumers and drive growth behind our powerful brands.
Joanne, we want to dig deeper into that, but let me ask you, if you had to describe the consumer in a word or a few words, how would you do it, and would you say that the consumer is back at pre-pandemic levels or maybe even better or still a little bit under it?
Yeah, the consumer is quite resilient. You know, we've been driving growth above pre-pandemic levels for several quarters. And, you know, that's most apparent at our Coach brand, where we've had more quarters in a row, but also true at Kate Spade and at Stuart Weitzman. And, you know, our business in the third quarter reflects really the strength and momentum we're seeing around the world. You know, we talked about our growth in North America. We drove 22% growth in North America in the last quarter. But we also saw strength around the world in all areas except for China. So we saw strength in Europe and strong growth in rest of Asia as well as in Japan. So business is performing. In fact, even in China going into the quarter, we saw strength and you know, that business only started to weaken when we saw the disruption related to COVID in the market towards the end of the quarter. So we're seeing a consumer that is engaging with our brands. They're getting out into the real world. There are real life occasions, And, you know, we see them engaging with our brands and our categories in handbags and footwear. And in fact, we just came off a great Mother's Day. So that continues, and the consumer really continues to engage both, again, with our brands and in our categories.
Joanne, I want to hit on the China point and dig into that a little bit, because you had to have, in North America, you overcame pandemic-related weakness in China when you look at the results overall. But I'm wondering, from a planning perspective, how you're thinking about how long these lockdowns last and how long you're going to see that weakness in China, where business has just dried up since this resurgence of COVID.
Yeah, the business was disrupted, but it was disrupted in a very discreet way, you know, by the impact of COVID in the market. And, you know, our business has been quite resilient over the last 2 years. As I said, you know, we've been driving growth above pre-pandemic levels for some time. And that shows the resilience of our model and the way that we're able to shift to changes that we're seeing in demand and changes in the supply chain and supply around the world. And our latest disruption has been in China. But as I mentioned, we had strength in the market, and we've been driving strength. As China mm-hmm. came out of the first round of lockdowns, the consumer was incredibly resilient. And we were driving growth significantly above pre-pandemic levels for a number of quarters. Again, as you pointed out, you know, they've been hit by another round of COVID lockdowns, and that has impacted traffic in the lockdown cities, but also more broadly. It's also impacted some of the distribution centers and logistics in the market. And so we're feeling the impacts of that. Our expectation is that, you know, we expect Shanghai to begin to reopen at the beginning of June, and we expect a gradual recovery, probably more gradual than what we saw last time we came out of lockdown, but we do expect a gradual recovery. And, you know, our brands are targeting the middle-class consumer in that market, which is an attractive market and growing market, and we feel well-positioned as that market recovers over the near term, but as well for long-term growth, you know, with longer runway ahead.
Joanne, there's so much stress out there, it feels like. Certainly when we watch the financial markets, right, and we look at some individual names, even though your stock's rallying, it's down about 25% this year. But it's broad-based selling. It feels like no market or sector is immune, it certainly seems, in the stock sell-off. You sound pretty calm, and you sound, I don't know, is it cautiously optimistic, optimistic? Help me understand fundamentally what the outlook looks like that might, you know, I think we're all trying to figure out what is the outlook amid a rising rate environment, and what is the business environment and what's the market environment? Because you seem pretty calm.
Yeah, well, and we are optimistic. We're very confident. You know, we have such iconic brands in our portfolio, and our focus has been on, you know, restoring the health of our brands and driving better and stronger engagement with consumers. And when we do that, the business performs. So we're really focused on fundamentals. And, you know, when we talk about transformation, actually, I heard you discussing investment in the business in the show just prior to when I came on. You know, we're investing in digital tools and innovation and technology that's making us better. And as we focus on the fundamentals, we're seeing traction. We're engaging customers. We're acquiring more customers. We acquired 1.4 million customers in the last quarter alone. And since we've embarked on our transformation, we've acquired 13 million new customers to our brands over the last 21 months. And these are customers who are coming in and engaging with our brands. They're shopping at higher AUR, higher prices than average, and they're coming back more frequently. And these customers are also increasingly younger. So as we focus on the fundamentals of our business, it gives us confidence because we're seeing much stronger engagement, much healthier brands, and much stronger engagement with our consumers.
Joanne, I'm wondering about your pricing power, because you said that these customers are paying more than they were paying earlier. How much of that has to do with inflation? Where are you seeing a rise in costs right now on your production end and in your supply chain? And how much are you absorbing of that versus passing it along to the customer? Because as Neil Saunders, an analyst with Global Data, said in a note after your results, the customers that you have at Tapestry can cope better with inflationary impacts than the average customer.
Yeah, and the way we think about our pricing power is really in terms of delivering value to consumers. And that's how we've been thinking about it. In fact, we started this pre-pandemic, before we started to see pressure on the cost side of the equation, and those pressures are real. We're seeing pressure on the cost side of the equation like others in the industry. A lot of pressure on, in freight related to the supply chain dislocations that we're seeing. But our focus really on the pricing side of it and the pricing power is really driven by the value we're delivering to consumers. And those emotional connections that we're developing are allowing us to drive pricing power. And we're seeing that across our brands. You know, some of the investments we've made and tools and technology are helping us leverage data better in across our value chain. So that's making us more informed on pricing decisions. It's also making us more informed on our assortment decisions and our inventory management. So we've got the right inventory. We're seeing higher SKU productivity with more concentration behind more powerful items, and that allows us to drive pricing power as well and to clarify our messages with consumers. So on the value side of the equation, we continue to deliver unbeatable value for our consumers across all of our brands. And that's helping us more than offset the pricing pressure that we're seeing in terms of cost, in terms of our expectations going forward.
You know, Joanne, when you were part of a Bloomberg panel that we did, you and I did it with a few other heads of companies about a year ago, and we talked about disruption as the new economic driver. I think part of the conversation we also got into what consumers want in terms of sustainability, and ESG is such a big part of everywhere. Tim and I are back from Milken, and we talked about it with every conversation. I am curious about how you guys apply it at the company, and I'm really intrigued about this craftsperson apprenticeship program, because I think it's a way of creating jobs. And also, you know, creating really strong sustainability initiatives at the company.
Exactly. Yeah, we're really thrilled to bring that to bear, that craftsman apprenticeship program. And the way we think about ESG has been part of the fabric of our company from the beginning. And we value and we think about it in terms of what we're bringing and delivering for our people, for our planet, and for our communities. And part of that effort and some of those efforts include sustainable materials and the circular economy. And Coach is a great example of where we're leaning into the circular economy with our Reloved program that takes product that can no longer be repaired, and we relove it, literally, and we restore it, and we bring it back to health. Our designers are working on it. Our repair centers are working on this product and restoring it and bringing it back. And we've seen unbelievable reaction from consumers. This is something consumers are asking for. It's something our associates love to do.
Yeah.
And as we think about scaling these programs, we are looking for more people to get involved in terms of leather craftsmanship. And that's part of the apprentice program that we're developing to allow us to further scale these programs.
Got to say, I'm an older consumer, but my daughter is 19 and she's a younger consumer. Those are the kind of things that really make us take a second look at a brand. So I think you guys are on.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently.
Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
To something.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week, the new issue just out on newsstands online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg terminal. It's about the return of the company's longtime CEO at Starbucks, along with a rise of a union movement among its baristas.
We're talking, of course, about Howard Schultz, the story by Josh Idelson. Check it out. It's the cover story, as Carol mentioned, of the new issue of Business Week magazine. It's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg, and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Josh is labor reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from San Francisco. With us here in person is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. Joel, I want to start with you because this is the third time that Howard Schultz has been at the helm of Starbucks. What is the Starbucks that he found when he returned just about a month ago as CEO?
The surprise, I think, that probably awaited him was one that he was not probably familiar with from his other stints, which was this newfound power that labor has. And Starbucks, which I found really surprising, the workers of Starbucks have, you know, for all of this talk about unionization sweeping the country right now, Amazon being one that we've talked about extensively, mm-hmm. all of those roads lead back to what has been happening at Starbucks. And Starbucks has been really, the workers of Starbucks have been a galvanizing force that a lot of other workers in corporate America have been inspired by. And Josh, to his credit, saw this long ago and started reporting the heck out of it and going to as many states and talking to as many workers who were behind the scenes of that union effort. And so what you really have here is a CEO who helped build this company into a global brand, comes back to it, and has found that the workers aren't buying that same vision that he had laid out long ago. And you see this tension between the workers and Schultz, and it even culminates with, you know, the workers being invited to the White House and the company sort of saying, hey, you know, we got cut out of this. So so Josh, you're somebody who follows labor obviously very closely. I think Josh is like probably as good as it gets in terms of labor reporting in this country right now. And what really distinguishes the Starbucks story for a wider audience here?
So in recent decades in the United States, it's pretty much unheard of for workers to win a labor board election at a company as prominent as Starbucks, where there isn't a union already and there isn't some kind of deal between the union and the company to play nice. And that this union not only won that first election in Buffalo, but has now won at 60-some stores and is petitioning to unionize hundreds of Starbucks cafes around the country is a movement with little precedent in the 21st century United States at a big company. And it is being done mainly through workers mentoring each other, not just workers organizing their coworkers, but workers training other workers to train other workers to train other workers to organize their coworkers. And that is how, as one worker put it, this ultimate group project has spread so quickly and has proven so difficult for Starbucks, despite all the resources at its disposal and the goodwill that it's had to stem this movement from growing and spreading further.
There are a lot of directions I want to go, Josh, but one question that continues to stick out to me is, you know, Starbucks is, as corporate, is very pushing back very aggressively when it comes to these unionization efforts on an individual level, even before Howard Schultz came back. Remember, he flew to Buffalo to meet with those unionizing employees. What is at stake here for Starbucks? If there is widespread unionization across U.S. stores here, to what extent does that affect Starbucks' business?
Well, there are two big reasons that companies tend to resist unionization, and one is money and the other is power. Of course, for the union to prove its worth to workers, it is going to need to show that it can extract things from Starbucks that workers wouldn't otherwise get, and some of those things are going to cost money. But the other reason that companies fight unions and that they often are willing to spend a whole lot of money both on anti-union consultants and on making improvements to try to mollify people, is that they don't want to give up that control over how the business is run. And Starbucks for years has bragged, including Howard Schultz has bragged, that there's an empty chair at the board meeting that represents workers' voice. So now you have workers saying, why is the chair empty? Put us in the chair instead. And in fact, in Buffalo, they're in collective bargaining negotiations proposing that Starbucks should have to put a representative of the workers on its board. And so for Starbucks to become substantially unionized would mean that Starbucks executives have less unilateral ability to decide what the business model should be, what the rules should be. And that's part of why the stakes here are so high.
Josh, what happened at the company? I thought this was the one where they paid their workers well. They had nice benefits. I mean, this is something that Schultz kind of took pride in, as you report. What happened?
So workers would answer that question in two different ways. And one is to say, it's not as dreamy as it may sound. Even the $15 minimum pay that the workers will be guaranteed by August is not a living wage for someone with a child in a city like Seattle. The staffing issues have been egregious at times, especially during COVID, and the handling of COVID disappointed some workers and left them feeling betrayed. But the other answer they would give is that it's not enough to be better than other fast food companies, and that they believe they should have more say in their working conditions and therefore in their lives, and that there is no one particular thing that Starbucks could solve that would make them go back to being okay with the company having all the control.
And where do things stand with Schultz? Because as you write, this is not a he's not permanently CEO right now, right? He's just back on an interim basis. So where will this dispute go?
That's what they've said. There's supposed to be a permanent announcement in the fall. There are some people hoping that Schultz stays on. But it is a fight that is deeply personal for Howard Schultz. This is his baby, and he has come back and made these personal appeals to workers, sometimes emotionally, intensely, as we see in the rooms that we go into in this story. And so this is not a struggle that he's going to be able to shrug off, whether he's in the CEO seat or not.
And some other companies watching this very, very closely. Josh, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Josh Idelson, he's labor reporter at Bloomberg News. This is the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands right now, on the Bloomberg, and of course online. Joel Weber, he is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So Tim and I were at the Milken Institute Global Conference last week. We talked a lot about the markets. Big topic touched on in so many panels and conversation was ESG. So we're going to get into that along with the macro environment with our guest. Great to be talking once again with us is Dave Gitlin, Chairman and CEO of Carrier Global. You know the company for making HVAC systems, refrigeration, so many different things that certainly affect all of us on a daily basis. And he's here in our Interactive Broker studio. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yeah, thank you for having me, Carol.
It's great to have you here, Dave. And I do think about, Tim and I were just talking, I mentioned when you walked in that we're watching the volatility in the markets and we're seeing so many asset classes come undone, it feels like, but in a controlled way. And yet, we just talked with the CEO of Tapestry. She was calm, said consumers are spending. Mm-hmm. She was optimistic. How do you see the environment? How do you kind of cross that with what we're seeing in the financial markets?
We feel the same way. We feel very confident in where we are and where we're going. And a big part of it has to do with the secular trends you mentioned, like ESG. But we looked at our first quarter orders. We're up 10%. Our backlog is up over 30% versus last year. So demand has continued to be very strong.
Is backlog up because of supply chain problems or just demand?
Well, partly. We have some overdue because of supply chain, but it's really because of demand. Our orders have been strong multiple quarters in a row. They continue to be strong. United States is very strong. Europe continues. There's a lot of anxiety about Europe, but if you were to be in one of our internal meetings, you'd be very bullish on Europe. Orders across our portfolio continue to be very strong. We have obviously a watch like others on China, but demand in our residential business, large commercial, our light commercial business, which is HVAC for things like K through 12, very, very strong in the United States. Retail with people coming back. So we do see very, very strong demand right now.
Would you say that the primary driver of demand is reopening, that desire for businesses and schools to make sure that they have clean and healthy air for the people who are in their buildings?
That's a big piece of it. If you take K through 12, it's a vertical that's traditionally been starved for capital. And all of a sudden, in the last year, they've been given $190 billion
by the U.S. government.
Yes, by the U.S. government. And it comes in three ESSERs. The last ESSER is $120 billion that's going to be spent over these next few years, and a good chunk of that's going to go to HVAC because it's not only to build more energy efficient, more sustainable type solutions, but schools are very aware of the criticality of the health of the indoor environment. And that's what COVID has really done, is shined a light on the criticality of having safe and healthy indoor environments. If you're in a school system, it not only helps prevent the spread of airborne illnesses like COVID, 1 in 13 kids have asthma. And then you also look at kids test better when you have lower CO2 levels. So there's multiple benefits, and a lot of that spending is going. So our K through 12 orders in the first quarter are up 50%.
Wow. So are we all, Dave, looking at things differently post-pandemic about, because we understand the air quality really makes a difference? Or is it just something that, okay, we were worried about in the pandemic and we're not so worried now? Are you saying that's, are you seeing that kind of as a sustained concern and then a sustained upgrade?
100%. You know, and I think what's happened is you can see there's a certain amount of anxiety when people go into very crowded indoor environments where you're shoulder to shoulder. So we're very confident that it's sustained. You know, if you take bottled water in the United States, people spend $36 billion on bottled water when it's free. And what's happened is people are sensitized to that's a safer way to drink water. What's going to happen with health air is because it's invisible, people don't know whether or not it's safe. Our job is to make air visible, and what we're selling now is a new digital platform we call Abound, which can make air visible. It's an aggregated scorecard of whether or not the air that you're breathing is safe. And our goal is to make that ubiquitous. So when you come into Bloomberg or you go into a restaurant or you go into a school, you can see it in the Atlanta Braves games in Truist Park. It's an aggregate score that tells you you are in a safe and healthy indoor environment. So that's our goal, to make it sustainable, is make it visible.
But this only works for HVAC systems and filtration systems that are carrier systems, right?
Our system can work with others as well. Like, it can overlay with anyone's building management system or anyone else's equipment. It's a digital tool that we've launched in partnership with AWS to really make it so, you know, in any where we can attach the sensors and collect the data, it looks at CO2 levels, particulate matter, radon, TVOC. So it's a way to kind of get data and make it visible so you get confident to go back indoors.
How much of what you're doing is upgrades of existing systems, Dave, versus what is new construction? Because I'm trying to get an idea of construction that's going on right now.
Well, in the large commercial side, it's 70% new construction and 30% replacement. And if we look at that space, we look at the architectural building index, because that's a 6-month leading indicator. People work on architectural designs in advance, of course, of construction. And the ABI, you want that to be north of 50. It's been north of 50 for 14 months in a row. So there is demand for large commercial buildings. In the residential and light commercial space, it's the reverse. It's 80% replacement and 20% new construction. And residential for us was up over 20% in the first quarter. Light commercial, which is things like data centers, retail, K through 12, that was up over 30% in the first quarter. So very strong demand in that particular vertical.
All right, I'm going to go back to you. You sound positive and optimistic.
Yes.
So I'm trying to figure out where we are in this economic cycle.
You know, I think there's this anxiety that is very understandable, because obviously with the inflation we've seen, people know that leads to rate increases, which typically slows an economy. So you can understand the anxiety. But when you kind of go back to things like secular trends, that we know there's going to be demand for things like more energy efficient HVAC systems. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, our orders for heat pumps, for commercial heat pumps, where we're the market leader, they were up 30% in the first quarter as Europe weans itself off Russian gas. You know there's going to be more demand for systems like heat pumps. You know that if you're If your air conditioner fails when it's hot, it's going to be replaced. You know, people are spending more time at home.
Our whole AC hopefully carrier heat system.
No, hopefully
I think it was.
So yeah,
sorry,
it's all good.
Don't put me on the spot like that.
You could help the quarter, Carol.
What's interesting, what you say is like it was an old system, 20 years or so, and it's much more efficient. Like it's just the technology continues to get better and better.
And we see people,
and the government require it.
Yes, and people governments incentivize it, but people are also mixing up. You know, because people spend more time at home, they don't want it when their air conditioner goes off and on, you know, makes that sound. So they're actually going for variable speed, more higher-end equipment.
Yep.
So to your point, there is this juxtaposition with anxiety about the future and some secular trends like ESG and healthy indoor environments, a rising middle class globally. Only 7% of people in India have air conditioning, and it's a pretty hot country, you know, 1.4 billion people. So you can see that these forces coming together that's driving demand.
We both want to ask you questions.
Please go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so climate change, what signs are you seeing of like you're putting systems in places you never thought you would put air conditioning at, like that just speaks to kind of what's going on in our environment globally?
Yeah, you know, what's really encouraging is the continued trend around heat pumps in particular for HVAC systems. So in Europe, almost all new construction is going to heat pumps in Europe for residential. We're seeing in the United States, states like South Carolina, we look at their heat pump, where they sell heat pumps with connected to their split system versus a cooling only. They sell more integrated heat pumps than they do cooling only. So the demand for heat pumps in the United States and globally is going up exponentially. More energy efficient solutions. In the United States next year, there's going to be the entire country is going to a switch to higher SEER units. In the South, 14 to 15 SEER, North, 13 to 14. So governments globally are incentivizing their populations to drive more energy efficient solutions. And that's what we do. So that's why there is this overall anxiety. But when you have things that can make a meaningful impact on climate change, that there's going to be demand. If there's going to be things that impact health and wellness, there is going to be demand there.
There is this overarching anxiety, but at the same time, you do sound really optimistic, as Carol said. But there is a lot to be concerned about. We've got concerns about the recession here in the United States. At Milken, we heard a lot about a potential recession in Europe and concern about the customer in Europe. What keeps you up at night? What concerns you?
Right now, our biggest challenge is keeping up with the demand. So clearly, we understand the concerns around recessions. And, you know, we all kind of read about it, and you can understand some of the underlying reasons why there is that anxiety.
Nobody's canceling orders?
No one's canceling orders. Our demand has, you know, our biggest challenge right now is truly keep, you know, we have chip shortages. We're working around the clock to rectify those. But as we operationally perform, we're taking share because we're able to support our customers better than some of our peers. We are managing inflation. We came into the year saying that we would get a 5% price increase, $1 billion on $20 billion of sales, in anticipation of $1 billion of inflation. The only good news with the anxiety that folks have about the economy is some of the commodities have recently been coming down, copper, steel, aluminum. Mm-hmm. So if we can keep prices at the raised levels that we've done, and if we get some relief on some of the commodities, that should drop through with some margins.
Dave, based on what you're seeing in terms of commodities, I thought that was a really important point. Do you think we have hit peak inflation?
It's hard to call that because every time we feel like it's peak inflation, the next quarter's worse. So I could tell you that we have seen over the last few weeks some relief, but it's really hard to anticipate what's going to happen a few quarters from now. You know, we've been able to now stay out in front a bit. So we've been very, very aggressive because last year we chased inflation all year with pricing. Yeah. This year we said we are not going to chase inflation. We are going to get out in front from pricing. We had good pricing in the first quarter, and we're very confident that we will do very well on the pricing side this year.
Dave, very briefly, 15 seconds. Are high energy prices actually good for you because it compels people to upgrade their systems to more efficient ones?
Yes, that does. Overall, that does drive demand for more energy efficient solutions, which is actually good for our business.
It's the only business where apart from oil and energy companies, right?
But you have to think about that, right? You've got to really think about all the different markets. Dave, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Dave Gitlin, Chairman and CEO at Carrier, joining us here in our studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we have about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Man, talk about a volatile one once again. Up, down. It's a seesaw market is how I'm going to describe it. We are definitely off our lows, as we just heard from Charlie. And really interesting to see investors coming back into the market. And I think this is the trade we continue to see, Tim, as investors try to figure out, at least on the equity side of things, where is the bottom?
Yeah, that's exactly what we talked about with equities reporter Jess Menton a little earlier, sharing with us some key technicals. But we are above those technicals, at least as of today. Let's get into it with Chris Zaccarelli, the Chief Investment Officer at Independent Advisor Alliance. Chris joins us once again on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina. Chris, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Are you doing well? This market's been pretty tough for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, I think the market has been a challenge, absolutely, and clearly we've had a lot of volatility, but I think it's not completely unexpected. You know, given what the Federal Reserve needs to do to get inflation under control, we can't say we're surprised, but obviously we'd love to get through this period of market turbulence as quickly as we can. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do to control it, so we just have to ride through the volatility.
All right, well, we're in the fifth week of that market volatility, so here we go, 2022. What is it out there on the horizon fundamentally that maybe gives you hope that you see some sign of a conclusion at some point later on this year, or do you feel like the visibility is not so great right now?
Well, I think we're definitely in a bear market. You know, clearly we're not in the technical definition of 20% down from the all-time high on the S&P, although we continue to get
closer. We got really close today, yeah.
We did, absolutely. But, you know, ultimately we think about it in terms of just kind of qualitatively. You know, the idea of a bear market is that investors just see everything as glass half empty, and that's clearly where we are. Now, some things that would give us confidence on the positive side of things is that, you know, the consumer still has a lot of cash on their balance sheet. Companies are equally pretty well capitalized. And so we're heading into a more difficult time where the Fed is raising interest rates. But the economy, for all intents and purposes, with the exception of obviously inflation being a challenge, is still on pretty strong footing. So for that reason, we feel pretty confident that you're not going to see a recession this year. Now, next year or the year after, obviously, that's anyone's guess. And unfortunately, as the Fed begins raising interest rates, the probability of recession increases. But as far as from a positive point of view, the idea that we're not going to have a recession this year could potentially provide a floor under the S&P, and we won't drop through that 20% peak to trough drop that you typically see with a bear market that accompanies recession.
Yeah, our Vince Signorella writing, the Fed is not, as critics like to say, behind the curve. It is actually way ahead of it, and as such, on the verge of a major policy mistake. So he's certainly concerned about the Fed overdoing it. You mentioned, Chris, consumer balance sheets, and yes, they are flush and have been flush because of all of the government stimulus, but that's not going to last forever.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And actually, if you think about it, part of the reason why we have the inflation problem that we have now is because there's so much cash in the system, whether that's from the federal government spending or whether that's from the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. You know, clearly all of that fiscal and monetary stimulus provided the preconditions such that, you know, supply chain issues and the other things that eventually started the process going, not to mention the war in Ukraine. But ultimately, with all that cash, it does set the seeds or does set the tone for inflation. And so at some point, consumers are going to need to pare back on what they're purchasing. They're going to have to make harder decisions. Ultimately, it just won't be a blanket statement that the entire stock market should go down. You're going to have to pick winners and losers. You're going to have to look at those companies that are likely to have pricing power and to be able to make it through a recession if there is one. And I think that's what we're looking ahead to, not just watching the market as a whole, but looking at, you know, a market of stocks instead of just a stock market.
Well, Chris, help us understand how you're thinking about opportunities right now. Are you putting cash to work, and where are you putting cash to work?
So we've raised a good amount of cash earlier this year in the concerns that we'd have a lot of volatility. We've been slowly putting cash to work. I think unlike in 2020 where there was a V-shaped recovery and it would have been very difficult to put cash back to work, this has obviously been a slower process. And as Carol mentioned, you know, we're 5 weeks into volatility. We think this entire year will probably be full of volatility because ultimately the volatility is being caused by uncertainty around inflation, uncertainty around Fed policy, and then ultimately uncertainty about growth. And we don't think any of those things will resolve in the near term. So there's going to be volatility. We do think there's opportunities for the market to bounce. As I pointed out in the notes, I think there's been a lot of bear market rallies that have been very sharp. As far as the things that we're slowly been putting back into the market, we've been looking at a little bit more defensive positions in terms of healthcare providers or things that we think will make it through a recession. And we've added a little bit more cyclicality as energy and some of those commodity complexes has sold off in recent days on growth years. We've added a little bit more to our portfolio because we think inflation will be a little bit more persistent than people are thinking, even though the Fed is raising rates.
Not hearing any of the high-flying tech names.
No. We reduced a lot of our tech exposure last year. We definitely were concerned not only of valuations, but also of the idea that, you know, tech and some of those longer duration assets, so to speak, were doing very well in a low interest rate environment, and they've had you know, tailwinds for over 30 years. But we did think we were going to move into a new regime of interest rates moving higher, and as such, we paired a lot of those positions. By no means are we underweight technology, but we had naturally gotten overweight technologies, I think everyone else had, just from the market appreciation. And so we just rebalanced in order to bring that back to a more market weight rather than necessarily a market overweight. And so obviously, given the way things have happened this year, that's turned out to be a good thing. But if we do head into recession, which we do think is likely in the next year or two, some of those technology names, like the ones that you're seeing selling off today, those really big cap tech, the ones that have great balance sheets, that have pricing power, that have a really great business model, they're the ones that are likely to probably do well through the next recession. So that's the conundrum I think people find themselves in.
All right, going to leave it there. Hey, Chris, thank you so much. Chris Saccarelli, Chief Investment Officer at Independent Advisor Alliance. They are a registered investment advisor, and he joined us on the phone from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.